I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for the vacationing Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. Coca-Cola is as American as apple pie and baseball. People drink it, sport the logo, and collect memorabilia. Award-winning magazine writer Michael Blanding looks behind the red and white logo of America's favorite soft drink in his new book, The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth Behind the World's Favorite Soft Drink, published by Avery Penguin. Blanding investigates the Coca-Cola Corporation from its origins through the development of its iconic American image, and its findings are shocking. I am pleased to welcome Michael Blanding to the Leonard Lopate Show. Michael, thanks for coming.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Now, I've got to tell you, I'm having a rough week because Christine O'Donnell is trying to take masturbation away from me, and here you are trying to tell me that Coca-Cola is bad for me. This is just nothing but bad news for Andy Borowitz, I've got to tell you. Are you a Coke drinker? Have you been a Coke drinker?
I have drunk Coke off and on throughout my life, but I actually started drinking more Coke when I started writing this book. I wanted to really know what I was writing about and keep in mind that it is just a bit of sugary refreshment at the end of the day, but the business practices of the company do not live up to its image.
And did you drink every variety of Coke? They have a vanilla Coke now, a cherry Coke. I drink the cherry Coke Zero, which is probably the most toxic substance on the planet. Did you try them all, just in the interest of journalism?
No, I didn't have a chance to sample all the flavors. I've been stuck to Coke Classic.
I see, Coke Classic. Well, how much did you know about the Coca-Cola Corporation before you delved into this book? And why were they a worthy subject for such a – this is a very thorough investigative report that you've done. Why was Coca-Cola in your crosshairs for this?
I first started learning about some of the allegations of Coke about 5 years ago, and I think, like everyone, I'd had an image of Coke, of peace and harmony and teaching the world to sing and all of that. And some of the allegations against the company are just shocking, involving violence against union members in South America, rampant pollution and water depletion in companies overseas like India and Mexico, and contributions here at home to health problems like obesity and diabetes. And when you add it all up, it just really shocked me and really made me feel like it was worthy of further investigation.
Let's take us back to the beginning, the sort of the history of this beverage. When was Coke first invented?
It was first invented in the 1880s. And it grew up in an era in this country where medicine was really in its infancy. Doctors were as apt to kill you as to cure you. And people took to dosing themselves with these home remedies called patent medicines.
Right.
And Coca-Cola was one in a long line of these medicines that it used substances like cocaine and cola nuts and other exotic ingredients and put it together and went for sale in the soda fountains, and the rest is history.
So that's, you know, I'd always heard that growing up, that there was originally cocaine in Coca-Cola, but now I've heard it from the expert. How much cocaine was in it? Was it enough to make you crazy, or was it just enough to give you a little lift? Or?
Not exactly. There's a preponderance of evidence out there that Coca-Cola almost certainly did contain cocaine, but it was probably a very small amount, probably only about a 20th or a 30th of what you would need to really feel much of a kick from it. At the same time, the company to this day continues to swear that Coke was never used as an ingredient. So you start to see some of the discrepancy between the story that they tell about the product and the reality of the evidence out there.
Right. So, you know, patent medicines, this was in an era way before any kind of regulation, or did they even have to – were any of their claims at this point in history verifiable or needed to be verifiable? It was all just whatever you slapped on the – side of the box or the jar was fine.
Yeah, Coca-Cola was actually one of the more legitimate patent medicines out there. A lot of them contain things like turpentine and a whole lot of alcohol and one actually, you know, that was marketed as snake oil. It gives rise to the term snake oil salesman even today. Coca-Cola actually did have some medicinal properties through the ingredients that it had present in it. But where it's like these other medicines is in just the incredible marketing that was behind the company even back then, that the patent medicines that succeeded were ones that created the most fanciful story or said they had the most exotic ingredients and really pushed to get their name out there as much as possible. And right from the very beginning, Coca-Cola excelled more than any of them.
So branding, they were at the forefront of that.
Absolutely. I mean, you could make the argument that the patent medicine industry created modern advertising, and Coca-Cola, in turn, created the image advertising that has continued to sell the brand to this day.
So, what as a patent medicine, what was it supposed to do for us? What was it supposed to cure? What were the ills that it had?
Coca-Cola specifically was known as a nerve tonic, that it was to cure headaches and to steady distressed nerves, which the South had in abundance after the Civil War and the destruction of the fabric of their society. And it was sold at soda fountains in the summers in Atlanta. And very quickly, within 10 years, it had expanded to every state in the Union. So they just relentlessly went out there and rode the rails and painted every barn and every rock with the Coca-Cola logo and got the name out there.
And how it's come a long way since then. How big a corporation is it now? What are its annual sales? How gigantic is it?
Its profits last year were $8 billion after
this is during a recession. This is during a recession.
Yeah, and the company's doing better than ever. It showed an increase the last quarter, even in North America, where sales have been down over the past few years. Worldwide, it blows Pepsi out of the water in terms of market share. It's really a massive corporation,
and it's a massive international corporation. Now it's global. I mean, it's we think of it as the quintessential American product, but it's actually manufactured and bottled around the world.
Yeah, exactly. Coke's distribution system is really interesting, where the product is actually manufactured at these bottling plants, which are technically independent entities in these other countries. However, the way that the system is set up, the Coca-Cola company here at home owns just enough in these companies to basically control what they do. At the same time, they can divest themselves of responsibility if any bad things happen.
And the Coca-Cola bottling plants, which are quasi-independently owned, aren't those really a license to print money? I mean, aren't those incredibly profitable enterprises for the people who have them?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, the company overseas, wherever it goes, oftentimes the Coca-Cola bottling plant managers are the richest people in town. They're the ones that own the bank and the pharmacy and everything else. It really is. They really are a kingmaker in some of these small villages where there aren't a lot of other industries.
I sense bad things coming along the way based on the way you set up this. All right. So now you visited some plants, right? Did you how many Coca-Cola plants did you pay a visit to?
I visited quite a few. I didn't always get inside the plants, but I certainly talked.
You're like Michael Moore outside the bullhorn.
not quite. A couple of plants they let me into. When I went to India, they let me inside some of the Coke plants. Other places like Colombia and Mexico, I wasn't so lucky. I had to talk to the people who lived in the surrounding area. But those are the three foreign countries I visited, and then I spent a significant amount of time in Atlanta and other places in the United States.
Well, so what was the experience like in India? What was the plant like? How were you welcomed, if that's the correct word, and what did you see?
The Coca-Cola plants in India are interesting. There's actually a big backlash against the company in the country for their water usage, where they have been accused of depleting water supplies in these villages, and at the same time, the effluent from the plants has caused a lot of pollution. And I visited one plant in southern India where the plant had actually been closed by a concerted effort of the villagers across from the plant, and then several other ones where they would take me around and show me the wells that were completely dry and show me the fields where the plants had dried up, and you could really see the evidence of the kind of environmental degradation that occurred there.
Mm. Did you get to talk to any of the people who worked at the plant, some of the workers, and were they able to speak freely to you, or did you get anything that gave you some insight into what their lives are? Their lives, clearly they're working and they have jobs as a result of Coca-Cola. What were their feelings about working for Coke?
It was hard to tell. You know, the viewpoints of the workers were very polarized. I would talk to some workers who were, you know, for example, in Colombia, where there was a lot of persecution of workers, or even in India, where some of the the same people who lived in the surrounding villages actually worked in the plant because that was the source of employment, and they were very conflicted about it. And then I would talk to other workers that the Coke managers would introduce me to personally, and of course they would talk about all the great things that the company was doing for the village and all the jobs that they provided. And so you got a really mixed viewpoint when you talk to the people who are actually working at the plants.
Well, you speak in the book I guess you make a lot of allegations about Coca-Cola's greed for money and power. But I guess what I'm wondering is, how are they different from other American corporations? I mean, just to put a name out there, I'm going to choose a name from random. Pepsi, for example. are Pepsi the good cops to Coca-Cola's bad cops, or is the whole beverage industry kind of this dog-eat-dog rampaging monster? What do you think there's something that typifies Coca-Cola as a greedy global corporation that sets it apart?
I think Pepsi is slightly better than Coke on some issues. For example, on health issues, they have been willing to work with health advocates a little bit more. They don't have the same kind of attitudes towards unions around the world. However, their water usage, they've been accused of many of the same things that Coke has done. You raise a good point, though. I mean, when I set out to write this book, I didn't want to paint Coke as this big evil corporation, like they were somehow worse than a lot of other corporations out there. But I felt like it was a really interesting corporation to explore because, first of all, it is such an iconic brand, and it's such a symbol of capitalism and such a symbol of America. And so much of the product is sold on the image that they've created over the years, that when you hold them up to that image and expect them to live up to it in their business practices, they fall short. And I think that's the basic hypocrisy that I saw in this corporation, which can be applied to other corporations, like, for example, BP, that spent so much money on their environmental branding, and we all know how that ended up. So I think there's a lot of lessons you can draw from the example of Coke that are applicable to a lot of other corporations as well.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because as you pointed out, even from their patent medicine days, they were kind of amazing on the branding side. They put a lot of effort into that. And, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and, you know, all those really iconic ads were kind of in the air constantly, and you really couldn't avoid them. Who were some of the minds behind Coca-Cola's branding? Were some of the giants of advertising? You have a sense the geniuses probably cooked up all of this stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like I say in the book, Coca-Cola really developed a new form of advertising in the early part of the 20th century, where before that, products had been sold on the specific qualities that the product itself had. It was called reason why advertising, you know, the reasons why you should buy this product. And Coke really pioneered this new form of advertising that was much more about the feeling that you had from the product, more about the image of the product. And in some cases, the product wasn't even in the ads, that they would just have these rich, good-looking people lounging about or playing sports, and there would be a little tagline that would say Coca-Cola, and really was the first aspirational advertising campaign where people would spend a nickel and feel like they could be initiated into this world. And that set the tone for all of the later Coca-Cola advertising campaigns that were to come, that are much more about, you think about the slogans and it's the real thing, or it's, you know, things go better with Coke. They're these very ephemeral sort of slogans that are more about your lifestyle than about the actual product that you're drinking.
And I want to buy the world a Coke.
And that's probably the basic example is, you know, teaching the world to sing. And they, you know, in the 1970s, when the hippie movement was in full swing, they glommed onto that and to create Coke at the center of this image of international peace and harmony.
Togetherness.
I mean, it's an amazing idea, if you think about it, that it could represent all that just in a little beverage.
Well, now, Pepsi, of course, countered with, or maybe they were first. You would know, Pepsi had, we're the Pepsi generation coming at you going strong, as I recall.
Exactly. And the Teaching the World to Sing ads were actually a response against that, because Pepsi had been so powerful in branding itself as the drink of this youth market.
Yeah, it's the Coke hippie. It was the hippie beverage. All the hippies loved
Pepsi. Exactly. Coke had to find some way to counter that, and they found that with their Teaching the World to Sing ad.
This is a little bit of a sidebar, but when did the Pepsi-Coke rivalry is one of those amazing sort of gladiatorial battles in American branding. When did that really heat up? When did Pepsi start gaining on Coke to the extent that Coke felt they had to, you know, fight back.
It goes all the way back to the beginning during the Great Depression when Pepsi really started to tout itself as a force in soft drinks in the country. But obviously it picked up after World War II and then during the 80s when the Cola Wars were, or, you know, national news. And the irony behind the battle between Coke and Pepsi is that I think one of the, I think it was a Pepsi executive that said, you know, the Cola Wars are actually good for both companies, that I think if Pepsi didn't exist, Coke would have to invent it, because during that period of the 80s when Coke and Pepsi were going head to head, soft drink sales just shot up through the roof. And that was when we really saw the big growth in soft drink sales in this country.
Well, it's amazing because as you discuss Coke and their sort of inexorable rise, you sort of feel this is a company that doesn't make a wrong move. And yet they've made a lot of wrong moves. I mean, the introduction of New Coke was kind of a disaster. What was the corporate rationale behind that decision? And refresh our memories as to how that played out.
Yeah, the New Coke fiasco is another interesting case. You know, we remember it today as this big public relations disaster for the company, and in some ways it was. However, in a way, it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to the company, that they determined through their taste test that they were losing ground to Pepsi, that people actually liked Pepsi better. And so they formulated this new formula that when they did the taste test, the blind taste test, that people actually preferred. And the problem was when they rolled it out, they forgot to account for their strength over all these years, which was their amazing image creation. And so when people drank it, it didn't matter what their taste buds were telling them. They wanted the associations that they had, the mom and apple pie and world peace that they had grown up with Coke. And so they actually rejected the sort of they thought tasted better for the one that made them feel better. It was sort of the ultimate triumph of image over substance. And about 6 months after they reintroduced Coke Classic, the sales were higher than ever. The people sort of reinvigorated people's memories and their rationale for buying Coke in the first place.
So they were able to turn a huge blunder into yet another success.
Yeah, there are people that say that it was all just a big ruse, that they meant to do it that way all along. I don't think that that's the case. I mean, look at the documentary evidence at the time, but it certainly worked out okay for them in the end.
Now, I didn't realize this, but... you say in the book that Coke was very involved in World War II, that they sort of played both sides. Is that true?
Yeah, the way that Coke expanded around the world actually was in part heavily funded by the United States government. They actually paid for them to set up bottling plants overseas to go along with the troops as sort of an essential item of warfare to keep up the troops' morale. The only problem with that was at the same time, Coke's German subsidiary was essentially doing the same thing with the Nazis and continuing to sell soft drinks to the Nazis. In fact, when they ran out of Coke syrup, they invented a new grapefruit beverage that they called Fanta. And after the war, everything was forgiven and all the profits flowed back to Coke. And they, you know, they were able to play both sides of the war at the same time. They really got credit for associating themselves with keeping up the morale of the troops and really wrapping themselves in the flag as a patriotic beverage.
Well, now, of course, there's a dark side, as if we haven't already gotten into some of this, with pollution and exploitation and all the other things that you're alleging. But obviously, obesity is a huge problem. Childhood obesity is a huge problem in this country. Diabetes. When did Coke first start feeling some heat for these things? And what actually do you think is Coke's culpability in the spread of these diseases?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, obesity is a complicated issue. This has a lot to do with exercise, with a lot of different foods. It's not just soft drinks. But there's a lot of evidence out there that soft drinks have uniquely contributed to the obesity epidemic. For one, the obesity rates doubled at the same time that soft drink sales doubled between the 1970s and 1990s. And there have been a number of studies that have shown a direct association, for example, that one of them showed that for every can of Coke that a child adds to his diet, his chances of becoming obese increase 60%. There's a preponderance of evidence out there that shows that that soft drinks as the highest percentage of calories in the diet has really contributed to the obesity epidemic more than any other substance.
I'm Andy Borowitz, sitting in for Leonard Lopate at WNYC and WNYC.org. I am talking to Michael Blanding, the author of The Coke Machine, The Dirty Truth, behind the world's favorite soft drink. Now, it's disturbing, and I guess I'd heard something about this, although you detail it quite a bit in your book, Coca-Cola's involvement in school lunch plans and even funding schools. When did Coca-Cola decide that they could make Coca-Cola the beverage of choice in our nation's school lunchrooms?
Yeah, this happened around the 1990s, where the soda companies, Coke and Pepsi and to some extent some other companies, you know, we're really running out of markets. We're running out of places to sell soft drinks in this country. And so they started signing these exclusive beverage contracts with schools as a deliberate strategy, one, to sell more soft drinks, and two, to hook kids on a particular brand early on in life, as a former Coke marketing exec flat out told me. And the problem was that this didn't sit well with a lot of parents and students and teachers, and began a real backlash against the company about 4 or 5 years ago, when people started speaking out against these exclusive beverage contracts as really taking choice away from kids and contributing to the health problems that they faced. And soda companies were ultimately forced to backstep on that issue and to cut many of those contracts.
But are they still funding schools to an extent, or has this been too hot to handle?
The evidence is really mixed on that. The soda company signed an agreement back in 1996 with the Clinton Foundation, where they agreed to voluntarily remove sugary soft drinks from schools. There are a number of problems with the agreement. First of all, it was completely voluntary. Secondly, it left in sports drinks, which many people look at as just non-carbonated soft drinks. And third, it kept the advertising in the schools, so they still had the brightly lit Coke machines in the hallways. And even though the soda companies themselves will tell you that they have been in 99% compliance with this agreement, and that they actually have removed the sugary soda from the schools, there are other studies out there, such as one that showed that 55% of schools don't even know about this agreement. So it's really hard to get to the
That's
truth
not a very
matter.
Good agreement.
And really find out what's actually going on in the school hallways.
You know, Coca-Cola doesn't have cocaine in it anymore, but what's your assessment? I know you're not a medical doctor, to my knowledge, but based on the medical professionals that you've spoken to, what is your assessment of the impact that Coca-Cola, the modern Coca-Cola product, has on the health of somebody who's drinking it?
I think that, taken in moderation, that it can be just another treat in the diet. It can be another beverage just like any other. I think the problem occurs when the sizes of Coke and other soft drinks have grown so much over the years, the amount that it's present in our environment. I mean, you walk into, you know, a Best Buy or a Staples, and there's the cooler of Coke at the checkout line. I mean, it's literally everywhere. And it's been a deliberate strategy of the company to get it within an arm's reach of desire, as one executive famously said. And I think that's the problem that I see, when it just becomes so integrated into our lives that we're drinking so much of it that it really, you know, a lot of doctors look at it as one of the biggest threats to health that is out there.
And of course, they've now diversified into water. They bottle Dasani. Isn't that their product?
Yeah, absolutely. That there was a real shift towards bottled water, especially as they started getting flack for all of the soft drinks that they were selling, and really touting bottled water as a healthier alternative, and pouring huge amounts of money and talking about the purity of the drink and the refreshment quality. You know, the same kind of tactics they used to sell Coke back in the day. The problem with that is that there have been numerous studies out there that have shown that bottled water on the whole isn't really any safer than tap water, which is already mostly perfectly purified and safe to drink. And in the case of Dasani, they're actually taking tap water from municipal sources, running through an additional purification method, slapping the Dasani label on it, and selling it to you for about 1,000 times the price. So it's a little bit of the emperor has no clothes.
And Dasani is just tap water that we're paying for.
It's repurified tap water, and they'll tell you all the space age, you know, techniques that they use to make it purer than it was before. But essentially, it's water that was perfectly good to drink to begin with, that they're selling it at a significant markup.
And unlike tap water, of course, we're putting many more plastic bottles out into the ecosystem, which is probably unnecessary. If you just bought a bottle and poured, you know, when you go to the gym, if you just add water to your bottle, you're probably helping the earth a little bit. That's just a little calculation I did in my head just there.
No, it's exactly it. I think there's been a lot of awareness that's been raised about that. I know here in New York City that there's been a lot of restaurants that refuse to sell bottled water, and a campaign by the city to tout its tap water, that people look at bottled water is really the highest contributor to plastic bottle waste in this country, and a lot of those bottles aren't recycled because they're carried with people on the go, and the company has taken a lot of heat for that.
And just one last question I have to ask you. You went to the Coca-Cola theme park. There's a theme park in Atlanta.
The World of Coca-Cola.
The World
Museum,
of Coca-Cola.
Yes.
What is the best ride there? What is the most amazing what is the most amazing attraction? Were one to want to go to the Wild World of Coke, what would it be?
Well, they don't actually have rides there. It's more of a museum that you go through on a tour. But
for the historical value.
The most popular exhibit there is at the end, where they have drinks from all over the world, most of them soft drinks. And I remember at the beginning of the tour guide was encouraging everyone to try every drink that was there, and there were 64 of them. And I just did the math in my head that if you had an ounce of every drink that was there, you're basically drinking a gallon of soda. So I don't know if it's the best place to bring your kids.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. The Coke machine, the dirty truth behind the world's favorite soft drink. My guest has been Michael Blanding. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow's show, Christian Science Monitor staff writer Scott Peterson takes us behind the headlines in Iran. Then jazz saxophonist Robbie Coltrane on his career in music and his legendary parents. Also, Sarah Gruen on her novel Ape House. Plus, veteran Newsweek reporter Michael Hirsch on Washington's apparent bias towards Wall Street. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Carrie Barber, Sasha von Olderhausen, Max Bass, and contributing producer Fran Jacobs. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Andy Borowitz in for Leonard Lopate. We'll see you tomorrow.